You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
So welcome to Brookings, what promises to be a very exciting event about the future of the U.S.-Latin American Economic Partnership. And this is, as you know, a prelude to the upcoming Sixth Summit of the Americas that will be held in Cartagena, Colombia, in about 10 days. My name is Daniel Kaufman. I'm senior fellow here in the Global Economy Group at Brookings. And for this session, I've been officially called the moderator. But in reality, because we want to have a very interactive session, I'll be a little bit more of an agitator and also get involved in discussion and in the comment. The objective is indeed that we have a very participatory and interactive session with substantive back and forth, not only among ourselves, which we'll do at first, but with you all. So this is how exactly we want to proceed today in the next hour and a half. First, we'll have our featured speaker, Leonardo Martinez Diaz, on my left, who will speak for about 20 minutes, delivering an important policy statement representing the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. government, as a result. And after that, Mauricio Moreira, on my right, will provide about 10 minutes of feedback and commentary. And then I will comment briefly and provide a bit of a question and challenge to them both and have a little bit of give and take between the three of us. And after that exchange, we'll have the very participatory session with you all, where you are going to be crucial participants in this. Now, to quickly get to the core substance of this session, let me tell you very much in brief some of the great virtues of both the featured speaker and the commentator. I'll be brief. I cannot go through all their accomplishments, writings, and positions because it would take too long, and it, in a concise way, it is in the program that you picked up. So sorry if I don't do full justice, and I'm totally exhaustive about that. But Leonardo Martinez Diaz, who is the Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Western Hemisphere at the U.S. Treasury, he served before as Director of Policy at USAID. Before, he was, in fact, my colleague. That's why we're friends here at Brookings in the Global Economy and Development Group, and was also involved in the Partnership for the Americas Commission. So he has had a long involvement with the issues he will present today and the policy prospects on that. He has also been involved with high-level commissions and reports related to the IMF and the World Bank. He has been a researcher at Oxford, focusing on politics and banking reform, and also on the reform and governance at the IMF, related to financial crisis management, and so on. He has been author and editor of a number of books, including one very appropriately entitled, even nowadays, Globalizing in Hard Time, and also of another edited book on Brazil as an economic superpower, which was, in fact, co-authored with Lyle Brainard, who is also a high-level official at the Treasury now and used to be at Brookings. He has a number of degrees, including a political economy from Oxford and from Northwestern University. And briefly about Mauricio Mesquita Moreira on my right, he's now the principal economist in the integration and trade sector in the Inter-American Development Bank, IDB, and before he was in the research department of the Development Bank of Brazil, BNEDES, and also taught at the Federal University in Rio de Janeiro. He's a lead author of a number of studies. I'll mention only a few. Like, for instance, Shaping the Future of Asia and Latin American Relations, which is coming up now. And also he contributed to the volume that Leonardo edited on Brazil as an economic superpower. He has advanced degrees from the University College in London. So let's go now to our featured speaker, Leonardo. We look forward. The floor is yours. Actually, the podium is yours.
Thanks so much, Danny, for that introduction. It's really good to be back at Brookings and to be surrounded by so many old friends and colleagues. And thank you very much, Mauricio, for agreeing to be part of this dialogue. When I was at Brookings, I was paid to be interesting, and now I'm paid to be the opposite, so you'll have to bear with me a little bit. Let me start by, giving you some remarks that are forward-looking and strategic about the relationship between the United States and the countries of the Caribbean and Latin America. And I think this is a good time to have this conversation so close to both the visit of President Rousseff next week to Washington, as well as President Obama's and other presidents, of course, assembling in the sixth summit of the Americas in a very few days. So I think that the timing is just right. And let me start by saying that there is no region in the world with which the United States has as many connections as it does with Latin America and the Caribbean. 50 million people, one in every six Americans, consider ourselves Latino or Hispanic and trace our roots to the region. This is often forgotten, but the United States exports about $370 billion a year to Latin America and the Caribbean. That's 3.5 times more than we export to China, and about 30% more than we export to the European Union. A third of our global crude oil imports come from Latin America and the Caribbean. Nearly a fifth of high-skilled migrants that are admitted to the United States every year through one of our key visa programs comes from Latin America and the Caribbean. So these are some key examples of how those connections that tie us together are very strong. Now, because the region has become so familiar to us over time, I think it's easy to forget how much the region has changed. And if you consider the region in the last two decades, you'll see, I think, some very impressive change. The beginning of the 1990s, Latin America was coming out of a lost decade of zero net growth. And yet at the beginning of the they had poverty and inequality that were stubbornly high. High inflation and hyperinflation were common. Fiscal imbalances were dangerously unsustainable. And banking and currency crises were common. But since 1990, the region's economy has more than doubled in real terms. Poverty and inequality have fallen significantly. Inflation is now mostly in the single digits across the region. Financial systems are generally stable. And macroeconomic frameworks in most countries are sound. In other words, Latin America today, many of those economies in Latin America today are engines of balanced, sustainable, and inclusive growth in a world that badly needs it. So my goal today is to identify some of the implications of these changes for the relationship between the U.S. and the countries of the region. And I want to leave you with two key thoughts. The first is that closer economic links between the United States and Latin America will be extremely important, in fact critical, if we are to accelerate and sustain U.S. growth and job creation. And the reason for that is that changes in the hemisphere over the last few years have ensured that those countries are today credible, responsible, and reliable economic partners. And that's a significant qualitative difference. The second point I want to leave you with is that the U.S. economy in turn will be indispensable for the countries of Latin America and the Caribbean as they seek to achieve their full economic potential and aspire to join the ranks of the world's most prosperous societies. And the reason for that is that the U.S. will continue to offer the biggest and most open markets for goods and services, the deepest and most liquid capital markets, and a unique capacity for innovation and entrepreneurship. Now, in the last part of my remarks, I will briefly put in a plug for what Treasury and the U.S. government have been doing without, giving away too much about the Summit of the Americas, but I do want to highlight some of the key initiatives that we are pursuing. So let me start with the first point, that Latin America and the Caribbean will be critical for accelerating and sustaining U.S. growth. And there are several reasons for this. The first is that Latin America is expected to continue growing. Growth for 2012 is projected to be 3.6%, and then growth for the region in the next, from 2013 to 2016, is expected to be on the order of 3.94%. Now, for sure, this growth is less than the extremely fast growth you saw before the 08 crisis, but nonetheless, it is still going to be considerably faster than the growth for the mature economies of Europe, Japan, and the U.S. itself. And another reason why the region is going to be critical for the U.S. Is that Latin America has a large and growing middle class, and that middle class is expected to keep expanding. Just consider this. If you take some of the numbers from the U.N. Commission for Latin America and the Caribbean, we'll see that the number of middle-class households in Latin America has grown by 56 million since 1990. In other words, the region's middle-class population has expanded by 150 million people in the last 20 years. That's about half of the population of the United States. As you can imagine, this is a really important source of demand, both for products from those countries themselves and from the United States. And in addition, and this is, again, another really important part of the new story, we see an unprecedented level of resilience that is evident in many of the countries of the region. Back in the 1980s and 90s, there were weak financial systems and unsustainable debt levels in countries, so that when there was an external shock, those elements would magnify the shock and make countries suffer considerably. In other words, when the U.S. caught a cold, Latin America and the Caribbean would catch pneumonia. But the region's experience since 2008 suggests that there's a historic shift going on. Colombia and Peru, for example, maintained positive growth throughout the crisis, and countries that were affected experienced a very significant and very quick recovery. Many economies in the region today are better equipped to sustain external shocks and to capitalize on positive global conditions than ever before. And that means that during downturns, Latin America can now be a source of stability and support to a global economy that badly needs it. And of course, there's always a risk of reversals, but overall, I am confident that these changes will continue in the medium to long term. And there's four reasons for that. Four powerful drivers are behind these trends. And those are demographics, competitiveness, capital, and policy. Let me briefly go through those because I think they're really important. Let me start with demographics. If you look at Latin America today and much of the Caribbean, I think you'll see that the region enjoys a demographic advantage relative to the rest of the world. This becomes clear if you look at dependency ratios, which tell us, which measure the number of working-age persons in an economy relative to those that are not in the labor force, you know, children and the elderly. And if you look at projections for Latin America from the UN, you see that the region still has another 20 years before dependency ratios bottom out at around 50 dependents for every 100 persons of working age. And then the ratios begin to rise, but only gradually. By 2040, the curve begins to get steep. By comparison, around 2035, China catches up to Latin America and then shoots up. This means that Latin America and the Caribbean will enjoy a significant demographic window of opportunity. There will be at least two decades when conditions will be very favorable for saving and investing and really getting ready for a new spurt of growth. Now, the second driver has to do with competitiveness, and here I'm primarily referring to Mexico. I think recent statistics suggest that wages, real wages in China, in dollar terms, have increased considerably. They've grown by about 19% in dollar terms from 2005 to 2010, and anecdotal evidence suggests that they continue to rise given a very tight labor market in China. In contrast, Mexican manufacturing, measured in dollar terms, remains extremely competitive. And though China, to be sure, has seen stronger productivity gains, which have offset some of the wage increases, nonetheless, there's a story here about an overall closing wage gap that will make some Latin American countries increasingly attractive as bases for manufacturing, especially for the U.S. market. Now, this is critical. This will not be a guarantee of increased competitiveness. Also, important investments have to be made in order to capitalize on this opportunity. Now, the third key element here is global capital. In the coming years, I think the global capital flows into Latin America will continue and may, in fact, accelerate. Expectations about relatively high future growth rates for Latin America, especially when compared to the rest of the world, will push capital in search of higher returns to the region. And this capital will be really helpful as the region tries to capitalize on its demographic dividend. And last, and arguably most important, I think, very bright prospects because of policy choices that the countries of the region are themselves undertaking. What we're seeing is that around the region, a very similar economic policy framework is taking root in many countries, very different countries, from Mexico to El Salvador, from Uruguay to Peru and Brazil. And this framework that I will refer to is above all pragmatic, it is homegrown, and it is being embraced by governments of all political stripes, both on the left and the right. And there's also very clear advantages that are becoming evident over time about why this framework seems to have seems to work better than the alternatives. So what is this framework? Let me sort of flesh it out a little bit. I think it's got sort of two components. One is about stability. The stability component of the framework has, involves things like fiscal discipline and transparency, which are helping countries avoid unsustainable debt burdens and secure reliable access to international capital. It's about credible monetary anchors. I mean, seven countries in the region have already, adopted formal inflation targeting regimes, which have helped keep inflation under control and have also allowed these countries to adopt more exchange rate flexibility. It's about greater exchange rate flexibility, which is allowing countries to adapt to external shocks at lower cost in terms of employment. And it's also discouraging dangerous buildups of mismatches in the private sector, which, as you recall, in many previous crises have been really destructive. And it's also helping countries avoid speculative attacks. A very important element here also is well-regulated and capitalized financial institutions, which have been critical in helping the region weather the 2008 crisis. Now, the second component of the framework is about growth. It's basically the recipe to try to generate inclusive and sustained economic growth in the region. Stability is important, but stability without growth is not going to be very fulfilling for anyone. And the elements of this part of the framework are also worth highlighting. The first is large and well-focused investments on infrastructure, education, and research and development. I think most countries of the region are recognized that without these three critical elements, it is very difficult to compete in an open global economy. The second is regulatory frameworks that encourage private entrepreneurship. I think most countries of the region now recognize that private enterprise is the most powerful engine for growth and innovation, even in countries where there's still a significant role for the state. Embracing a rules-based open trading regime has been critical in helping many of the countries of the region tap large markets. Countries as diverse as Jamaica, Honduras, and Colombia have been able to do this thanks to an open trading regime. Openness in capital flows has been also extremely important. This year, Latin America will experience or will have experienced $113 billion of FDI from outside. And the reason they've been able to do this is partly because of openness to capital flows. Measures to mitigate inequality of opportunity and to protect the most vulnerable have been also extremely important in order to show that the framework doesn't just work for the 1%, as it were, but also for the broader population. And here, Latin America has really made a very important contribution. Mexico and Brazil, through their own cash conditional cash transfers, have really have pioneered some of these efforts, which have been replicated in many parts of the world. And efficient and increasingly progressive tax systems are also being embraced both for equity considerations and in order to ensure that the state can provide public goods. And finally, I'd say that another element of this framework that is emerging is an increased interest in stabilization funds to help protect economies from declines in commodity prices and to protect themselves from these kinds of shocks. Now, this framework that I've just described is a work in progress, but its basic tenets are being endorsed across the hemisphere. And so the central challenge now is how do we institutionalize this framework in institutions, in regional and local institutions that are effective and legitimate. Now, although a lot has been achieved in recent years in Latin America, I don't want to obscure the fact that Latin American and Caribbean countries still face some very significant development and economic challenges. In many places, poverty remains endemic. Income and wealth inequality remain dangerously high. Social exclusion continues, and vulnerability to natural disasters remains a serious preoccupation. In the Caribbean, there's concern about a self-reinforcing negative triangle of low growth, deteriorating financial positions, and financial sector stress. In Mexico and Central America, there's obviously concern about crime and insecurity, which risks undermining institutions and which is very costly, not just in human terms, but also for businesses there. And while we hear stories about Latin America's new dynamism, let's still remember that GDP per capita, real GDP per capita, has still grown at much too slow a rate, especially if we compare them to some East Asian economies. So effectively addressing these challenges as we look forward is going to require strong, sustained, and effective growth. And this is where the U.S. plays an important role. In the coming years, the U.S. is going to provide Latin America and the Caribbean with some extremely important opportunities to capitalize on the current window of opportunity. And let me tell you why. Let me start with trade. The U.S. remains the world's largest market, and is geographically close to the region, of course. And our markets remain among the most open in the world, even at a time when protectionist measures appear to be proliferating in other parts of the world. Now, the U.S. is also important not just in terms of trade or the amount of trade, but also in terms of the composition of the trade. The U.S. will provide some important opportunities for countries that seek to keep their exports diversified. Let me give you an example. Brazil is a case in point. You know, Brazil's trade with China has grown substantially in the last decade, but the composition of that trade today looks more like Brazil-U.S. trade in 1950. In other words, over 85% of Brazil's exports to China are basic goods and raw materials, while more than 90% of Brazil's imports from China are manufactured goods. In 2011, Brazil ran a deficit in manufactures with China of about $25 billion. But Brazilian and U.S. trade, by comparison, is complementary in a different way. About half of Brazilian exports to this country are manufactured goods, regional aircraft, auto engines, cell phones, machinery. In turn, Brazil imports from the United States large commercial aircraft, semiconductors, computer equipment. There's a different kind of complementarity that arguably can help Brazilian industry remain competitive. Now, if the European economy grows more slowly in the years to come, the U.S. market will become even more important as a source of opportunities for Brazilian industry and for Latin America seeking to continue to be diversified. Now, Brazil is not a unique case. I can tell you a similar story about Peru, which exports 80% of its exports to China are metals and minerals, but 40% of Peruvian exports to this country are non-traditional higher-value goods, which can help produce good jobs in that country. Now, the U.S. will continue to be an indispensable source of capital for the region. Today, U.S. companies have over $200 billion invested in Latin America, and our capital markets remain the deepest and most liquid. Every day, Latin American companies and governments tap our markets to get the capital they need to operate and grow. And by the same token, and this is kind of a new story, an emerging story, the U.S. will provide important opportunities for Latin American investors as they seek to find a place to invest their capital. And this is already happening in a small way, but you can already see it in the statistics. In 2010, outward foreign direct investment from Latin America and the Caribbean reached an all-time high of $43 billion. Most of these investments are multinational companies in Colombia, in Mexico, in Brazil, in Chile, looking for new pastures, new horizons. Some of that money stayed in Latin America in some of the neighboring countries, but a lot of that came to the United States as well. For example, today, Mexico-based Grupo Bimbo is one of the largest baking companies in the United States, with bakeries in 13 states and employing 15,000 American workers. Another example, of course, is the Brazilian steelmaker Gerdau, which produces steel in 19 states and employs 10,000 American workers. And I think we'll see more of these stories. We'll see these stories become more common in the years to come. And finally, the United States remains home to over 50 million people who trace our roots to Latin America, as I mentioned at the beginning. And of course, they're very important because these diaspora communities connect the U.S. to countries everywhere, from Mexico to Colombia, El Salvador to Haiti. And of course, they're best known for providing very large amounts of remittances, about $40 billion worth of remittances. But I think there's something even more important, that these diaspora communities can become agents of change in private enterprise, combining American know-how, business know-how, and knowledge of local opportunities in Latin America to create successful businesses that cross borders and tie our hemisphere together. This is, again, an emerging story. I can't show it to you in the numbers yet, but anecdotally, I think we see quite a lot of it materializing. Now, in view of all of this, let me turn to my final section here, which is about how do we see these opportunities and what is the U.S. government and U.S. Treasury doing to stabilize these. Thank you. Doing to capitalize on these. First, we will support countries implementing the stability and growth framework that I mentioned. We will do this through our bilateral and multilateral policy dialogues, through our policy actions on the executive boards of the IMF, the World Bank, and the Inter-American Development Bank, and through our technical assistance program. Treasury has a relatively small but very effective technical assistance program. It is currently providing institutional capacity to 10 Latin American and Caribbean countries through dozens of programs. Now, second, we will work with the region's largest economies to strengthen our economic and financial partnerships. And here with Brazil, for example, we will use the presidential economic and financial dialogue, which, of course, will be part of the conversations between our presidents and our ministers next week, to seek stronger collaboration on issues like infrastructure finance and addressing the problem of global imbalances. With Mexico, we'll continue our very intense dialogue. Mexico, of course, remains one of our closest partners on a range of important issues, and as well as a key partner in interdicting and stopping financial flows from organized crime. Mexico, I should add, as current chair of the G20, has played an important leadership role, and in particular has become a global leader in financial inclusion, which is an issue that Treasury and other parts of the U.S. government care about. We're also committed to strengthening and deepening our relationship with G20 member Argentina after it addresses some concerns on a variety of issues, including engagement with international institutions and payment of final ICSID awards and Paris Club debt. We think the potential for partnership here is large, and we would really encourage Argentina to address these issues as soon as possible so that it can be fully a member of the G20. And in the G20, we will work with our regional partners to advance common interests, including restricting protectionism in trade and addressing global imbalances, as I mentioned. Third, we will support and collaborate with Latin America and Caribbean-owned regional institutions. We think this is very important because regional institutions are closer to the people they serve. They're closer to the problems they're trying to tackle. Let me start with the Inter-American Development Bank. This is still the largest provider of multilateral investment in Latin America. And as you know, the U.S. government has recently committed to a replenishment of the Fund for Special Operations and to a significant increase in the capital of the institution, of the Inter-American Development Bank. It has basically doubled the IDB's disbursement capacity from about $6 billion to $12 billion. And we will continue to encourage the IDB to sharpen its focus tackling poverty, building public-private partnerships, and advancing regional integration, which is so important for many countries, especially the Caribbean and Central America. We welcome the growth in of innovative and effective regional institutions, such as the CAF, the Andean Development Corporation, now renamed the Development Bank for Latin America. And we're also encouraged by innovative efforts to pool stock markets, for example, MILA, the Integrated Latin American Market, which is an ongoing effort to pool together the stock markets of Chile, Colombia, Peru, and eventually Mexico. And we will also engage more closely with regional institutions in the Caribbean, especially the Organization of Eastern Caribbean States and the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank. Fourth, we will continue to promote development and resilience in Latin America through a variety of innovative, small-scale, but hopefully very effective initiatives. And you'll hear, I think, President Obama announce several of these in the next Summit of the Americas. Let me give you a couple of examples of the ones we have already put in place. The first is the Migro Fund, which is an innovative public-private partnership to ensure access to capital for microfinance funds. Through the G20, we have put in place the Small and Medium-Sized Enterprise Finance Challenge of 2010, which has allowed many small and medium-sized entrepreneurs to access capital. And together with our partners Canada, Spain, Mexico, and Colombia, we have launched what we call the Crossroads Fund, which is meant to support high-impact regional infrastructure. And through the President's Partnership for Growth in El Salvador, we are tackling some of the key constraints to growth in that important country. Now, the last thing I'll say is that as we travel through Latin America, one of the things we hear about is that the American private sector is not as engaged as it once used to be in Latin America. And because of that, we as the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. government, we want to work very closely with the U.S. private sector to make sure that American business still has is able to compete in a level playing field in Latin America, and that the U.S. private sector also understands and is fully informed of the opportunities that exist in Latin America. We'll continue to work with both the financial community and with our companies here to do that, and, of course, in collaboration with the Department of Commerce, USTR, and so on. So in conclusion, this is a special moment of opportunity that must be seized both for us here in the U.S. and across the hemisphere. A deeper, more mature economic relationship between our countries is rising, is developing, and will be increasingly important for growth in the United States. At the same time, access to the opportunities the U.S. economy provides will be essential for Latin America and the Caribbean as it looks to reach a new level in its development. And together, I think, we'll be able to capitalize on these the auspicious period of stability and growth that we have now entered. Thank you very much, and I look forward to having a conversation both with our panelists here and with the rest of you. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Leonardo. That was excellent and crisply delivered, already with a lot of food for thought. Without further ado, go to Mauricio.
Okay. Thank you very much. Well, good morning. Many thanks for the invitation and you know, for this opportunity to be here. It's not every day we have the chance of discussing with the U.S. Treasury the future of the U.S. and LAC relationship. And let me start by congratulating Leonardo for the very well-thought speech. I know that's not very good for the debate, but I just happen to agree with most of the things he said. I think he got most of the diagnostic right, and and as a consequence, he also picked the right priorities, I think, not just for the relationship, but in terms of the challenges of development for the region. And I'm not saying that because, the U.S. is the main shareholder of the IDB, but I just happen to think that any objective analysis of things that are going on in the region, in the relationship, would come to the same sort of conclusions. So rather than disagree with the things he said, what I'm trying to do in my short 10 minutes is try to pick in one of the issues he raised and try to elaborate a little bit more. And perhaps one disagreement I might have is in terms of the emphasis of the issues he raised. So my main point here is that I believe that the landscape on the relationship has been operating, the U.S. and LAC relationship has been operating in the last 10, 15 years has changed dramatically. I mean, when we think about the discussions we had during, the FTAA period, I think it's, sort of a black and white. And I believe that the main single factor responsible for this shift, and I would say this tectonic shift, is the emergence of China, and Asia as a whole. I think it clearly changed the equation on both sides. And I know there's a lot of people that believe, and I agree that the appearances might suggest that because of this emergency, the case for stronger integration between the U.S. and LAC is not as valid as it was before, that the both economies will drift apart because you now have other options. But I just happen to disagree, and I believe that it's quite the contrary. Unless one believes that this is the final crisis of the capitalism, you know, this sort of nonsense, I believe that, you know, China emergences and all the Asian countries that are coming behind only makes, you know, the case for a stronger integration between LAC and U.S. only make this case stronger, and I am trying to explain why. You know, as you know, China has been a very welcome new source of demand for the region exports, and also increasingly a new source of capital, and it's particularly convenient in times of crisis like that. So there's no doubt there's been a huge benefit for the region because of China and because of Asia as a whole. But at the same time, it has raised this specter that the region is going to specialize again in, you know, a small number of commodities, which is sort of a colonial trauma. You know, people really get really worried about that in the region. So, and at the same time, it has questioned the ability of countries like Mexico and Central America to use manufacturing exports as a source of growth. So this is, I think it's a key issue. And whatever you think in terms of an agenda to meet those challenges, I think that the greater integration with the U.S., either by reducing trade costs, you know, traditional and non-traditional trade costs, or by increasing FDI, should be part of the solution and not the contrary. Leonardo has already mentioned, and one just have to look at the composition of trade, bilateral trade, between the two economies, that, exports, LAC exports to the U.S. are much more diversified than it is to China and for Asia as a whole. So if the region's really worry about diversifying, sophisticated its exports, it's clearly a no-brainer. I mean, it has to deepen its relationship. It has to, you know, increase its integration with the U.S. economy and not the way around. And it's not surprising that it's like that. I mean, it's the comparative advantages in manufacturing between the U.S. and LAC are much more complementary than it is with China and Asia. And it's going to remain like that for quite a long time. I mean, it's true that, you know, you can make an effort to diversify exports to Asia, but, you know, the natural resource pool is so strong that, you know, I think it's totally unrealistic to think that in 10, 15 years, LAC is going to be exporting a lot of manufacturing goods to Asia. So I do think that in a context like that, the U.S. market and the regional market assumes where, you know, the inter-regional trade is also much more diversified than, you know, trade with Asia as a whole. But I don't think the region can take these opportunities for granted. You know, this fact that there's this more diversified trade with the U.S., that this thing is going to continue forever because, you know, the competition is there, and the Asian competition is there, and it's putting a lot of pressure on the regional manufacturing exporters. And like Leonardo, and perhaps here is my main disagreement, I'm very skeptical that the Latin Americans as a whole can count on labor costs to compete. Yes, I know that wages in China has been rising fast, but the fact is, and you look at Latin America, you know, in many of those countries, wages are fast, are rising even faster, helped by, you know, exchange rate appreciation. And even so, when you think in the medium and long term, I mean, China still has roughly 40% of its population in agriculture. These people are going to move into manufacturing eventually, which is going to keep putting, a downward pressure on wages. And even if you, you know, think that China, okay, it's going to graduate fastly, India's coming along with, you know, equally huge population, which is going to make competition in labor-intensive goods even harder. So, When I think of the future in terms of, you know, making sure that the region can diversify its exports, I think that the key main advantages are in natural resource intensive goods, I mean adding value to the natural resources that the region has, and the fact that the region is close to the biggest market in the world. And also has a big domestic market to take advantage of. In other words, the advantages of proximity. So either natural resources or proximity, these two factors make things like transport costs and logistics a strategic importance that they didn't have before. So when we think about in terms of a bilateral trade agenda, I would, you know, put a lot of emphasis on those issues. It's not just, you know, trade barriers and trade agreements anymore, but making sure that, you know, the region, by investing in infrastructure, by, you know, improving trade facilitation, by improving business at the border, it can take advantage of those type of advantages in natural resource goods and time-sensitive goods, you know, things that where it can really compete with the U.S. If we look at, for instance, the manufacturing exports that Mexico is doing well in the U.S., it has been, you know, withstanding well the pressure from Asia, it's exactly those type of goods that are very transport-intensive or time-sensitive. So it clearly shows that, you know, where the advantages are. And in this sense, I very much welcome the emphasis that the Treasury has put on this type of agenda, you know, the transport costs and logistics agenda, the support that the Treasury has given to, you know, initiatives like the Crossroad Fund. I think the IDB, it's very much on this direction. And again, it's not that I'm saying that, you know, the old trade agenda is over. You know, we just have to look at South America. You know, there's a big agenda there in terms of bringing tariffs and non-tariffs down. But clearly, I think there is a big return in this other agenda, which has the additional advantage. It doesn't require the type of broad political consensus that you need for, you know, pushing trade agreement forwards. And then I'll come to my last point. I'm hoping to have some time to go on. And my last point, I think there's another important area of cooperation between the two economies, which are directly related to this need to diversify exports in the region, and it has to do with the enforcement of the international trade rules. I don't think that, you know, it is in the interest of any Latin American country, even the large ones, that, you know, heavy government intervention, aggressive trade policy becomes the norm in international trade. I don't think LAC has the political institution and institutions, in this case, I'll think, you know, I'm glad for that, and nor the resources to face this kind of a strategic policy world where states have a big influence in who wants the competition. And it just happened to be that, you know, the U.S. government has been giving a lot of signs that it also doesn't see those type of practices as something that should be part of the international trade. So why not cooperate more on these areas? You know, why not, you know, pushing for, you know, an international trade where the states have, you know, a smaller role, that things like exchange rate manipulation, subsidies, and, you know, has a much smaller role to play than has been having so far. I really don't think that, you know, that those kinds of tit-for-tat strategies that you see some countries in the region doing, you know, trying to, you know, boost their state, increase their state companies, you know, sort of mimicking some kind of strategy you see elsewhere, it's going to solve the problem for the reasons I explained before. And it has this huge risk of taking us back, you know, to the problems that we had in the 70s, of 80s, of, you know, of fiscal you know, the fiscal problems and the high inflation that comes with it. I will leave it there. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks, Mauricio. Excellent speech, excellent comments. So I will complement by making a few brief comments, which are going to be also leading to questions on three areas I would like to comment. And I take the prerogative of being the moderator and lead challenger, but also being the only one in the podium who does not represent an official institution. So here at Brookings, it's all our views, so I can speak more freely and try to push you both a little bit, even though you provided already a lot of substance. The first question is about the whole approach of the U.S. to Latin America. There have been a lot of noise over, for years now, about the neglect, increasing neglect, benign neglect, or so on, for many geopolitical reasons on how the axis has changed. I think your speech and also the facts that you mentioned suggest that that's certainly not the case. And I'd like to ask not so much the question, has there been so much neglect, which you're for sure you're going to refute, but the more subtle question that perhaps, and there I speak as a Latin American also, not only being in Brookings and knowing the U.S. a bit, but I'm from Chile, has the U.S. gotten increasingly behind the curve in that relationship? And to what extent what you're telling us today and in terms of the way of moving forward is an attempt to catch up in being behind the curve? In what sense? In the following sense, I don't think... And you show it to an extent that the relationship between the U.S. and Latin America over the past 10, 20 years has changed much. So that means the good news is that there hasn't been really an increasing trend towards neglect. But that's part of the problem, that it hasn't changed that much. When you even mention it, and you mention it again, Latin America has changed dramatically. And the question is whether the U.S., in its relation to Latin America, has adapted to that change. In fact, if I look at the numbers, FDI numbers, trade numbers, aid, they look annual averages eerily similar the second term of the Bush administration with the first years of the Obama administration where we have the data. It's like having an incredibly stable line. But also in terms of policies and so on, there may be a sense of continuity, which in general is good. But here is the question. Given the seismic shift in the region in Latin America, we have not weighed in non-economic issues, but since they do matter for economic, I'll mention quickly. It's no longer the eras of full of dictators. It's an exception, not the rule. Civil wars, remember those days, in the old days. Instead, the robust growth, the macroeconomic discipline. We have become grown up to a large extent. Just to illustrate that, you mentioned very high figures for the U.S. in terms of trade. They are true. In 1991, Latin America trade with China, exports plus imports, totaled $1.2 billion. Nowadays, it's $200 billion. Okay? During that period, the U.S. in 91 had $263 billion, so it's about 250 times China, and now it has $600 billion, which is enormous, but it's only three times more than China. And for some countries in Latin America, including my own, China has become an even more important partner than the U.S. So this is your part. But the shift is absolutely seismic. Okay, so that's question number one. To what extent the U.S. has adapted, which leads to the question number two. You mentioned a number of very valuable and interesting initiatives. You praise them. And this question I always ask, so I'm not discriminating because I come from a more macro tradition in many sense, do these specific regional initiatives really make the difference as opposed to the much larger policy initiatives and macroeconomic background? What, just to be politically incorrect, chicken feed programs on the one hand, I used to be in the World Bank for a long time. So we had always, for the president's speeches, long list of initiatives. 80 or 90% or so didn't count by much. Those are the million-dollar initiatives versus the billion, multi-billion-dollar questions, which I would call the elephants in the room, some of which may be politically difficult for you to mention in the speech, but I'd like you to address. So let me mention, number one, if I was so interested, and you mentioned the $600 billion in total trade between the U.S. and Latin America, and propel that forward, obviously, first and foremost question I would have, the U.S. macroeconomic management and macroeconomic stance. How the U.S. is doing and to what extent it's going to be more responsible than in the past 8 years or so, even though over the past year there has been an improvement, granted. That matters probably more than most other things. You mentioned in passing, and I'd like to backstop that because it's so important, trade barriers. The ethanol tax. The U.S. imposes trade barriers on Latin America in particular objects. To what extent that may be part of the agenda of being addressed or not. And then weighing in even more sensitive areas, which I work on, so I'm biased, but they matter so much for the economy, so it's not just for mentioning it, and that's issues of related to governance. The drug wars, and the drug problem obviously has enormous economic implications. To what extent that would feature also in the economic calculations to have a particular effort, will that change? Because it has been relatively successful in the past in Colombia, but in Mexico we have a very mixed record of what's going on. Corruption is a big concern. Interesting enough, it's not in the speech, even though you used to talk a lot about it when at Brookings, but maybe that's not part of the Treasury mandate. And another elephant in the room is the issue in terms of drugs, the legalization issue, or a different approach than the current approaches that are not working particularly well, which leads to the third and last comment slash question, which is one area where the challenge between the U.S., and no, this is totally just my view, with all the disclaimers, no official affiliation to those views. A common challenge in terms of the U.S. and Latin America is, in fact, this challenge of less than optimal, to put it mildly, national-level governance. In the case of Latin America, I totally agree, and I mentioned that, there has been a major improvement on economic policy areas and many other achievements, and particularly the macroeconomic stance. I think there are many lessons that many Latin American governments can pass on to the U.S. in that context. But one area where we have stayed stuck on average is institutions, quality of governance, issues of corruption, rule of law. That I would expect that because other issues and other constraints are being relieved, that's going to be the binding constraint to continue that robust growth and performance. And if those issues are not seriously addressed, we are going to see some disappointments, and we're doing some work in that area. So, of course, there are exceptions, and one cannot just talk about the region on average, and the countries like Costa Rica, Chile, Uruguay, Colombia have made serious inroads, and they're good examples of what's possible. But then there are countries on the exact other extreme, and there are many countries modeling in the middle. Brazil has made inroads too, but it's not the norm across the region in terms of institutions, in terms of governance, in terms of rule of law. On average, we have stayed stagnant. That's better, and let's be very frank, than what has happened over the past 10 years in the U.S. If we look carefully at the data and the evidence, there's been a deterioration in many of these governance dimensions. And we know very well what has happened even until now on Capitol Hill related to very important macroeconomic decisions that do matter. And there are many other examples in terms of rule of law, the issues of increasing in a distortive importance of, of campaign finance, and how that also distorts policy making and creates even more inequality in the polity and in the economy. Many of those issues we have been grappling for Latin America for decades. So I think it's an opportunity now, since on the one hand Latin America has shifted. We have grown up. The U.S. has run into issues. To use this type of summits and other events to say, look, we're both now talking as equals, as grown-ups. Why don't we also discuss very sensitive issues? Not like the old days, the U.S. lecturing us in Latin America. And President Obama is incredibly adept at that, as saying, look, we have these huge challenges. And he recognizes them in terms of governance and so on. Why aren't those issues then more on the agenda, since they matter so much for the economy, first for the U.S., which in turn matters for Latin America, but also in the Latin American region itself, we have not addressed those issues as well as we have done in other sectors. So those are my three comments. So if that's okay, maybe first you may want to comment on both of us, then to you, and then we'll start opening it
up. Well, let me start just with pulling together some of the really provocative and interesting themes that you have pulled out. The first is this issue of adaptation behind the curve, right? Look, there's no doubt that the world is more complicated now. Now we have, for the Americas, you have now a variety of new opportunities, new markets, new sources of capital. The increased assertiveness and confidence of many of the countries in the region means that when we talk to them now in bilateral and multilateral settings, we don't just talk about U.S. Brazil or U.S. Mexico or U.S. Chile. We talk about the world. We talk about those bilateral issues, but on top of that, we talk about regional issues, and we talk about global imbalances. We talk about the IMF and the European crisis and so on. And that is a significant change in the tone and the quality of our relationship. Now, the U.S., of course, is a large, pluralistic, and complex society. And to say that, I think we're in the middle of a process of trying to understand how we are changing as a country and how the region has changed in the last few years. And because of that, I think it's going to take a bit more time before a clear picture emerges. But you already see some key themes that are really exciting and really important. Before, it was all about sort of donor-recipient types of relationships, for example, right, on the aid flows. Today, you see that the amount of aid that we're providing Latin America is a lot less prominent. A lot of the aid now is going to other parts of the world. But the kind of aid we're providing to Latin America is changing. We're putting a lot more now into institution building, into capacity building, into assistance to help now pretty sophisticated institutions, central banks, finance ministries, and so on. Before, there was a real scarcity of economists in many countries. So we had to, the U.S. provided some of that expertise in central banks and finance ministries. These days, they have entire rooms full of PhD economists who have very sophisticated skills. What we talk about now is what have we learned from different types of, financial products? What is the, what kinds of really experiences are we sharing? And it's that fundamental shift between, donor recipient, between, mentor and mentee, if you like, to a relationship of equals where you have really an exchange of experience, an exchange of ideas. And I think that is really important to underline. Now, the issue that you raised, which you have devoted so much of your career to institution building, is one that we think is extremely important. Now, Treasury, as I mentioned, has a technical assistance program. And we're really proud of it because even though it's quite small, it puts U.S. Advisors in finance ministries, in central banks, working side by side with some of the people who work there, and work with them for years. It's really a long-term process, trying to help develop a new cadre of locals in issues like debt management, revenue policy, budgeting, financial crimes, banking regulation. Institution building is not a flashy, glamorous activity. It happens over long periods of time. It's not very photo op friendly. It depends a lot not just on resources and technical issues. It also depends on political will. And, you can put a lot of, effort into helping a tax agency in a country develop and professionalize and become clean and competent. But if, the leadership changes And now you have people who, you know, somebody who's willing to put all his friends in charge of the tax agency, and you fire all the professionals and so on. You can go back years. So we always look for opportunities where there is both a political will to invest in institutions and then the patience and the dedication that's needed to really make it work. In terms of kind of chicken feed versus the big stuff, right? Chicken feed versus macro. I mean, I agree completely. If you don't get some of the big things right, it doesn't matter what else you do because it won't work. One of the things that we're trying to do here in the U.S., of course, is to try to get our own house in order, both in terms of medium-term fiscal sustainable path, and also to get back into sustainable growth. You know, I think so far the signs are positive. This year, the projections are about 2.2% growth for the U.S. We see, employment generation. It's not where it should be yet, but there's been 3.3 million jobs generated in the last 2 years. That's about half of what was lost during the crisis itself. In certain industries, we see some positive signs. I think automakers are really making a significant comeback. And I raise automaking in particular because it has such an important role in parts of Latin America, Mexico, Brazil in particular. And so I think over time we are getting to a point here in Washington in the U.S. where the U.S. can continue to be an important source of the opportunities that I mentioned in the speech. And lastly, how do we make, if we do have sort of small initiatives, a couple of million dollars here and there, what have we learned, right? How are these going to be of any consequence? Are they just deliverables or announceables, right, for principals and presidents, or are they actually going to be meaningful? And what I'd say here is that we have learned something about how to make small programs have a multiplier effect. So a lot of, for example, the crossroads that was mentioned. The crossroads element is meant to leverage private capital. It puts in a little bit of public money to have this sort of multiplier effect. With the investments in institutions, you know, we have relatively modest investments in people and advisors, but hopefully you are able to leverage a whole institution over time. And so this idea of multiplying forces is, I think, behind a lot of the cutting edge of these kinds of programs. And we're doing our best to make sure that all of our programs have at least some of that.
Great. Leverage and multiplier effect are crucial. But as you said, it has to be complemented by the house being in order first and foremost.
Absolutely.
So that's crucial. I did not mention it explicitly, and in your response, I would be very interested about issue that you cover from your perspective, how crucial the not only free trade is, or less barriers to trade, but freedom of movement in terms of labor, because I did not put you in the spot, but maybe later you can come back. The whole issue of migration and immigration to the U.S. is absolutely crucial. The numbers in terms of remittances and how crucial that is for Latin America in the tens of billions of dollars a year, and for some country it's a huge part of the GDP, is absolutely crucial. So the policies, that's another example of just one policy of the U.S., one way or the other in terms of immigration, that can basically make or break the deal. That's another elephant in the kitchen, like the drug issue, like the macro and so on, as opposed to a small program that may have a lot of multiplier effects. So as an economist also, in terms of the integration issues, the issue of freedom of movement of labor is pretty crucial, and they are the U.S. issues are crucial in terms of the relations with Latin America.
So let me just make two comments. First, on the aid issue that you mentioned, I think frequently people talk about this thing and you know, raises the fact that China is giving a lot of money to the region. There's a recent paper also tried to measure the amount of loans that China has given. So there's this sort of race. Who gives more to the region, and especially in terms of aid. And I really don't think that this should be the metric by which one measure how important a relationship should be. I think the emphasis should be, what is the relationship that opens more the markets to our products, to give us more business opportunities and so on and so forth, and not, who give us more aid or stuff like that. I think the region has already developed enough to, to use this factor as one major a metric to judge any relationship. On the issue of migration, I agree with you. I think there's clearly benefits on having more free labor movement. I think Leonardo has mentioned in his speech the fact there's a huge diaspora, Latin American diaspora in the U.S. I think this could be, you know, as the Indians have shown us, could be a major thing to help to develop business in the U.S. And you know, help bringing technology opportunities to the region. I don't think that the Latin Americans have used this possibility, this potential, well enough. And yes, I think it should be part of the discussion in the bilateral relationship. But obviously, one has to think of the political constraints that exist on this type of agenda. I think even Latin America now recognizes that this is not an easy issue. I mean, the migration that is being occurring of Bolivians and Paraguayans to Brazil and to Argentina. So I think it should be part of the agenda. But there is clearly other, lower hanging fruits that we could, reach for.
What would be the two most important ones?
As I mentioned before in my comments, I think there's trade, which is, it doesn't have to be. Trade barriers doesn't have to be huge trade agreements. Particularly if we're talking about, Brazil.
So the ethanol tariff, you agree?
Yeah, but as I understand it, it was dropped by the Congress. So it isn't an issue. On the contrary, it's something that helps to advance the agenda. And there's a few other tariff picks. There's problems on both sides, and I think it should be part of the agenda. And the logistic part of it, just all the regulatory stuff, the things on the customs. It's not something that costs a lot of money. Doesn't have a huge political cost in terms of forging a consensus, and then you can move forward faster with big returns in this kind of issues without trying to reach for more controversial topics.
Thanks. To the floor now. Who wants to ask the first question? You are from Trinidad and Tobago. We have the mic. And if you can introduce yourself. I know you're ambassador from Trinidad and Tobago, right?
Thank you. Sorry, I can't stand. I'm actually injured a bit, but I'm the ambassador of Trinidad and Tobago. And gentlemen, thank you for a wonderful presentation. But specifically, I probably just wanted to make a comment more as it relates to the first speaker. Very often, the Caribbean is almost lumped together with Latin America as a matter of convenience almost. And I'd probably like to make a general comment by suggesting that as an economic space, it's fundamentally different. And, some of these islands are 600 square miles with a population of 50,000 people, but they're categorized as a country. And in many instances, they lack the critical mass to really sustain a tax base for, even sustainable economic development. So it can become a bit of a challenge when the region is seemingly functionally categorized with Latin America, geographically, surely, geopolitically in many instances, but economically, if it's not almost peeled off as a region and treated with its own idiosyncrasies, it will forever be rate-limiting and prohibitive to our own development. So it's just a general comment I wanted to throw out on the floor. Thank you.
Thanks. We'll collect a few more, that's okay, and we'll come back to the comment. Who wants to comment next? It's a quick lady at the very end. That's good that we have good geographical presentation.
My name is Corey Sue Morris. I'm a master's candidate in Latin American Studies at GW, and I also am the communications manager at a social compliance nonprofit. My question was, a lot of times these summits, you just sort of, they're good for relations between the countries, but nothing actually happens. Are there any sort of goals, do you think, particular nations are hoping to achieve with the United States? And do you see these actually meeting with success after the summit?
It was great. Thank you. Go ahead.
Hi, my name's Simon West. I work as a consultant at Control Risk. We're a risk management firm focusing on Latin America. I just have a question about the balance of growth in Latin America, because there's a lot of sort of agreement around the progress that the region has made over the last 10, 15 years. But it strikes me, somebody goes down to the region, a lot of it's very heavily focused in urban centers. And you go out into the rural areas and there's still huge poverty, there's still huge disparities. And you have communities that are being sort of very much kind of split apart by young people either migrating to the cities or to the United States. So my question is around kind of, is that a kind of sustainable growth given the huge disparities that are emerging between rural and urban areas, and what threat could that pose to stability in many countries over a longer term?
Thank you. We'll take one more now, and then we'll come back to the panelists and then get back to the audience. Please.
Thank you. Hi, David Nelson from GE. Infrastructure investment was raised as one of the key factors determining growth that countries are focused on, and yet Latin America lags significantly behind East Asia in development of infrastructure. It's great that the capital increase for the IDB and so forth is being implemented, and yet the Asia Development Bank, as a matter of policy, dedicates 80% of its funding to infrastructure. The IDB, I think, has a much broader mandate and doesn't have that kind of a focus, so it's not clear that the money is going there. And you look at things like Brazil preparing for the sporting events, there's a lot of questions about whether infrastructure is catching up. What can be done to increase the amount of funding for infrastructure? How can that be accomplished in Latin America?
Okay. Why don't we come back to Leonardo first, and then all of them are relevant for you.
Right.
So go ahead.
The Caribbean, absolutely, you're right that it's a very different region in terms of its economic logic, its terms of its geographic composition. And we have one of our desk officers here, for example, is just focused on the Caribbean. And we just traveled, several of us in our office have traveled recently to the Caribbean to try to understand really the very unique challenges that the region is facing. That's why when I mentioned during my speech regional institutions, one of the things we're trying to do more actively is to engage with the regional institutions of the Caribbean that really have a better understanding and potentially some solutions to some of the Caribbean's problems. One of the key issues, of course, is that many of those economies are not complementary. They're producing the same things, tourism, financial services, and therefore there's some barriers to integration, which is something that we have been trying to encourage for a long time. But ultimately, you need to have strong incentives, economic incentives for integration in order for it to work. So we're planning to work more closely with both governments in the region and yourself as well, if you want to participate in these dialogues, to see what else can be done. Partly because the Caribbean, as you know, many of the countries fall in the kind of middle-income and sometimes high-income groups, and therefore they sort of no longer apply to some of our bilateral aid programs. Maybe that's appropriate, but we need to find another way to engage in a productive way with the Caribbean countries and the region as a whole. In terms of the goals of the summit, I think the summit has, I think, a couple of purposes. One certainly is symbolic. It is important that all the presidents of the region come together at least once every few years as a sign of solidarity. And also, a lot of what happens at these meetings doesn't happen in public. It's the bilaterals, the opportunities for presidents to exchange views in a frank way on ongoing issues, and that's really quite important. And let's not underestimate the importance of presidents getting to know one another, of interacting one-on-one. That becomes actually quite useful when it comes time to negotiating or to dealing with sensitive issues. It's much easier once you have actually met the person and have spent some time getting to know them. And, of course, you'll see, I think, a number of important initiatives that will be announced, at least by the United States, having to do with many of the issues we've talked about here. Energy integration, infrastructure finance, diasporas, and so on. And I think once they're announced, you'll see that there's quite a rich set of possibilities there. Not all, perhaps, will be in the category of macro transformational projects, but many of them have the possibility of having this kind of multiplicative effect. urbanization and the balance of growth, extremely important. There was recently a paper, I think, from Goldman Sachs suggesting that Latin America is one of the most urbanized regions of the world, and yet it hasn't fully capitalized on the economic benefits of cities. I think as we go forward, how to build and improve smart cities will be an essential challenge for Latin America. It not only relates to security and instability, but also to how do you actually turn these cities into hubs for innovation and entrepreneurship that can become engines of growth. And I think you'll see a lot of that in the future. In terms also of how do you, not everybody's going to live in cities, of course, and there will continue to be parts of countries that are, as it were, off the grid. And a key question for us at Treasury is, well, how do you include some of those populations into the financial system? I mentioned during my speech financial inclusion. That agenda is exactly focused on that. How do you get populations that are not part of the formal banking system to tap into that system? How do you use mobile technologies? How do you use new approaches in banking and other financial services to make sure that more and more people can participate in the essential element, which is financial services, insurance, savings accounts, loans, mortgages, even if they're not necessarily smack in the middle of a major metropolitan area. And I think you'll see a lot of really important advances in this area in the next few years. Infrastructure, finance, and infrastructure in general, really critical. It is one of the key bottlenecks in order to really emancipate the full potential of the region. And the problem is that a lot of capital is needed, a lot more than governments can provide, a lot more than even current savings levels in countries suggest can be provided. And so that means that new sources of capital will have to be tapped. We're encouraged, first of all, by the rise of new institutions. The expansion, for example, of the CAF that I mentioned is useful because it provides a new source of pooling capital for infrastructure. We're increasingly talking to the U.S. financial community to try to understand what new products and what new vehicles could be perhaps attractive to them in order to pool capital and make it available for Latin American governments to put into infrastructure investment. And ultimately, what we really want to try to advance, and I think our Brazilian counterparts are very interested in, for example, is how do you build long-term capital markets in these countries? That's in some ways the holy grail. How do you finally build local currency markets for long-term investments? And that is, that's something the U.S. has been able to do over time, and I think it's an experience that a lot of people are interested in and want to know more about, because that's ultimately how you're able to tap and mobilize very large amounts of resources without having to worry about exchange rate risk. And that's, I think, something you'll see increasingly discussed in the economic and financial dialogue and in other forums.
Thank you. One possible issue, which usually the most interesting issues in summits are not necessarily in the agenda, and they're pushed by some constituencies, and I assume the issue of drug trade will come up with a lot of pressure from some Latin American governments. Is it safe to suggest that the U.S. will not be able to offer, for political reasons, any new breakthrough policies on that issue? Because that's one of the elephants in the room that will probably come up, even though if it's not formally in the agenda.
Look, I think you have already a changed dialogue about the problem, right? So, a couple of years ago, we already have, I think, a greater appreciation for the fact that it's a two-way problem, that it's not just about drug production, but it's about drug consumption. It's about weapons and financial flows in both directions. And so I think that's, as a first point of departure, that was a significant step. The question now is, well, what do you do about it? How can we do this together? And I think in terms of the sort of the drug legalization argument, I think you won't find too much sympathy for that, because the U.S. already spends quite a lot tackling the problem of demand. There's been quite a lot of progress over the last few years in reducing demand. And frankly, the options for doing something different are complicated. There's not a lot of easy silver bullets in this problem. And I think there won't be any silver bullets offered at the summit. The question is, how can we use the collaborations that we currently have, both in terms of introduction of financial flows, improving security, governance, and so on, how can we do better in those areas?
Great. We'll go in a minute, but I want Mauricio to comment on particularly on the good infrastructure question from Mr. Nelson on GE, and I want to push you beyond what we all know and your bank and yourself has been saying for so many years, which is obviously infrastructure is crucial for development. But there are serious questions also on composition, and I'm glad that you raised the issue of Brazil and the World Cup and the questions about it, because some commentators would say, good thing that they're not spending as much as they should be spending according to FIFA in all these wonderful stadiums and so on. South Africa is a good example of totally misguided billions of dollars expenditure for a World Cup at the expense of education. Hopefully that's not happening in Brazil. But there is an issue of composition, particularly because the governments have to find the money, have to spend the money, and the revenue goes to Switzerland, goes to FIFA. So that's an issue of global governance, which is for a different debate, and we'll discuss that. So let me push you, not only in terms of the obvious importance of infrastructure, but when there are the funds, are they being spent smartly on the composition issues?
Yeah, no. Very briefly, I think you make a good point. I mean, the ADB is basically an infrastructure bank, and the IDB has all this agenda, education. The IDB spends between 30 to 40% on infrastructure, and the rest is education, institutional agenda, social agenda in general, which is obviously a key issue for the region as well. And obviously, we have a budget constraint, set by our shareholders. So
I was just relieved a little bit by Leonardo.
That's right, yeah. But, you can always say there's not enough money, that we need more money. But I just happen to think that, particularly for the large countries, it's not a matter of money, and I think it's much more a matter of priorities. Instead of spending money, a lot of issues that are very questionable in terms of the returns they can bring, if they get their priorities right, and get the importance that infrastructure can have, on social issues, but particularly in terms of trade, and so to allocate those resources to those kinds of objectives would make a huge difference. And there's also something that you already mentioned, is this: how do we spend those resources, which I think is critical. I think it was in a country like Brazil, I think the major bottlenecks is the ability to implement those projects in an effective way, and to put together a regulatory framework that would give the private sector the right incentives to participate in this effort. If you manage to do those things, to get your priorities right, and to build a regulatory framework that promotes reduced uncertainty for private investment, it's not going to be an issue about money.
Thank you. One thing that even Leonardo will agree with me that has been totally constant in the U.S.-Latin American relationship and tradition over the past 20 years is that we are always 7 minutes late. So we started 7 minutes late. If that's okay with you, we'll have another round and come back to the panel, even if we go a little bit beyond the noon. I see quite a few nods. Since the microphone is here, we'll go here first, and then we'll go to you in the back.
Thank you, and thank you for a great presentation. My name is Patricia Fernandez Lefebvre, and I'm from South Florida, and clearly our whole economic situation in Florida is so dependent on Latin America. One of the issues that we're facing, obviously, right now, and my question is to both gentlemen, how do your agencies play into this, is that we have a lot of Latin Americans, particularly Brazilians, that come and support our area, that want to establish businesses, which would certainly help our job market, but the visa situation is almost impossible. How are you able to influence that? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Ian Talley, Dow Jones. Talking about all infrastructure needs, Mr. Martinez You referred to the necessity to deepen capital markets. There's been several complaints, however, that the new Basel rules requiring higher capital standards will are going to force, particularly the emerging markets, are going to impede development and deepening of those capital markets, and all as well as the Volcker rule. How do you balance, you say that there's a need to deepen capital markets, how do you balance that need and these new capital requirements, and do you see a way through this? Happy for you to answer as well.
Yes. We'll take two more, then we'll come back and end with the panel.
Thank you. My name is Yoneyama from Mitsui & Company, Japanese multinational. Question is about the Rio Plus 20. How is U.S. Priority for green stuff for through the Rio Plus 20? And also IDB, how IDB is going to prioritize the opportunity for infrastructure investment? Thank you.
Right behind you, the last question.
Hello, thank you again for a great presentation. I'm Sharita Wilkins with Partners of the Americas. My question is directed toward Leonardo. You highlighted some of the areas of cooperation between the United States and some of Latin America's bigger players like Mexico, Colombia, and Brazil. However, we do have some strained relationships in Venezuela and Cuba and other parts of the region. How do you see the initiatives you plan and the Treasury plans to implement in the region affecting those strained relationships with the countries?
Great. We'll come back to Leonardo. Feel free to provide the answers to the question, but also if you want to make a concluding remark after that, because this is your last
sure.
chance. And then if there was a question to you, too. And then.
Look, on the visas issue, obviously that's not in the competency of Treasury. What we can say, though, is that, going back to my speech, the issue of the of diasporas and the capacity of the region to provide skilled labor to improve competitiveness and innovation in this country is quite important. And in interagency discussions about that, that's one of the issues that that we want to raise as one of the agencies primarily concerned with the health of the U.S. economy. In terms of the of Basel and the Volcker Rule, both of those sets of rules, in the case of the Volcker Rule, still under development in terms of the actual regulations, those are seen as really important elements for an enhanced and strengthened international financial system. We believe that they are necessary in order to make the system a lot more stable and to prevent the kind of crash that we have seen in the last few years, which has had such high costs for all of us. And so I think a lot of the international community agrees that these are really important parts of the system in order to keep it stable. Now, in terms of actually balancing some of the elements that you mentioned and applying the Volcker Rule, for example, is a highly complex a piece of regulation and will touch on very many elements of the financial system. And because of that, the government has expanded the comment period for all kinds of stakeholders to provide their feedback. And we're currently going through a careful process of reviewing those comments and we'll dialogue with other countries about what kinds of implications are there going to be for debt markets and other kinds of financial markets, and what kinds of precautionary changes are maybe necessary, and most importantly, what is the phase-in period that would be most appropriate. And so those are still ongoing dialogues, but we're very much paying attention to what all the stakeholders are telling us. On Rio Plus 20, I'm afraid I don't have a lot of detail. That's a different part of Treasury and the State Department, of course, which is leading a lot of the work there. Needless to say, we are especially interested in finding new ways of using innovative finance to try to improve green development in general, and I think that's something that we'll continue to push at Rio Plus 20. And finally, on strained relations, you're right that there's some countries that are not necessarily part of the sort of framework of stability and growth that I mentioned, and we're concerned that because of the policies that they are undertaking, they're going to have a lot less room to maneuver. in case there's external shocks, in case there's commodity price changes. One of the advantages of having the stability and growth framework I talked about is that it allows for more flexibility. It gives you more wiggle room in terms of your fiscal policy, your monetary policy, and so on. Some of the countries that you mentioned don't have that kind of wiggle room, and their policy choices have not given them that kind of countercyclical capacity. And so we're concerned that because of that framework, if the situation changes abroad, they won't be able to react quickly enough. And so we're trying to encourage these kinds of policies to be put in place so that they have more flexibility. And you know, more generally, I think there's ongoing dialogues to continue to see where there can be room for progress on financial and commercial issues.
Thank you, Maurice.
And just very briefly, yeah, I agree with this issue that you know the more regulation on the financial system is going to reduce the room for financial institutions in the region to expand credit. And this is might be, you know, a cost, particularly because they have already done their homework, you know, years before. But at the same time, nobody benefits from, a world financial crisis that like we had before. So if this is the price we have to pay to have a more stable world financial system, I think I would favor a movement like that. And on the Rio Plus 20, I mean, I don't have the specifics of what the bank is going to do there, but I'm sure it's going to keep pushing its agenda of, you know, trying to develop infrastructure, but, you know, with a clear eye on the environment, try to have, you know, projects that, you know, balance those costs very clearly. You know, not much more than that to say.
Thank you, Mauricio. I think it's very appropriate, and you've been so good in managing expectations in terms of major achievements at the summit itself. But who knows? Maybe something wonderfully unexpected may happen. Why? Because after all, and you did not mention that, the setting is going to be probably the most magical in all of the Americas, and that's Cartagena, Colombia. So maybe something will happen. So thank you very much for you.